Today's sponsor is the amazing Uni Dragon. They create and sell premium sets of wooden jigsaw puzzles and offer jigsaw puzzles for both adults and children to entertain all experience levels. I've recently just completed the Majestic Wolf puzzle. It's a colourful design and made in wood, which makes it super sturdy. What I love about Uni Dragon jigsaw puzzles is that their designs are extremely unique, and they even come in their own unique shape, as opposed to the regular square or rectangular. They've got some amazing new designs up on their website, including the playful parrots and the fiery fox. Uni Dragon jigsaw puzzles come in a great quality box too, which make them perfect for gifts for your loved ones as well. This makes them really easy to store if you're like me and you enjoy collecting jigsaw puzzles. Jigsaw puzzles really are a great way to pass the time. They're fun, and they're a low-stakes activity which can help reduce anxiety and even increase your memory and problem-solving skills. Listeners of Morbidology have a special discount code for 10% off their order on unidragon.com. Just use the code DRAGONB4. That is DRAGONB4 at unidragon.com, and make sure to hit me up on social media and let me know what jigsaw puzzle you got. Before you go any further with this episode, I want you to download the free app Vodacast and listen to this episode there. Vodacast is a podcast player, but what sets it apart from regular podcast players is that they provide deeper digital stories. For example, you could be listening to this episode on Vodacast and immerse yourself in some bonus content, such as photographs related to the case, including photographs of the victim and photographs of the criminal investigation, as well as links to newspaper articles and much more. As you listen on Vodacast, the bonus content appears at the appropriate time in the episode, so you could be listening about certain evidence and see it on your screen for yourself. I'm going to be mentioning certain things that you can see on Vodacast throughout this episode, so download the app now to make sure that you don't miss out. Just click the link in my show notes or search for Vodacast on the Apple App Store or Google Play. Welcome to Morbidology. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, Mysteries Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join Morbidology on Patreon for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, exclusive merch, ad-free and early release episodes, and much more. In 2013, a teenage girl in Glenburn, Maine, vanished after walking to the bottom of her driveway to meet somebody. Over 500 concerned locals offered up their time to search for the missing girl, and truly bonded together to try and bring her home safely. The investigation into her disappearance would uncover that the person she had gone to meet was somebody she was speaking to on Facebook. Her disappearance and the outcome would lead to many parents questioning, "Who is my child really talking to online?" It was the 14th of May 2013 when police in Glenburn, Maine, asked the public to keep an eye out for 15-year-old Nicole Cable. She had been missing since Sunday, the 12th of May. That night, she left her home at around 9 p.m. and was allegedly shortly thereafter seen walking on Route 221 in Glenburn. When she hadn't returned home by the following morning, her mother and stepfather, Christine and Jason Wiley, reported her missing. Police refused to say whether Nicole's disappearance was suspicious or whether she was in danger. However, they did reveal that her mother, Christine, had informed them that she had been scheduled to meet somebody that she had met on Facebook. Nicole was a typical teenage girl. Her parents had separated when Nicole was younger, and she lived at home with her mother and stepfather. She loved upbeat music because she could dance to it, and was really close with her three younger half-sisters, Annabelle, Emma, and Julia. She also got on extremely well with her older brothers, David and Michael. As most teenagers, Nicole could rarely be seen without her mobile phone in her hand. She was always texting her friends and chatting away on social media, mainly Facebook. Her mother would recall that on one occasion they had taken a two-week family camping trip to Moosehead Lake, and Nicole struggled without her phone for those 2 weeks. Her best friend, Tyler Ann Harris, said that Nicole always had a smile on her face, but said that she quite frequently had an attitude. She quipped, "She was a teenage girl." You can see a photograph of Nicole up on the Vodacast app. Nicole was a sophomore at Old Town High School, where Superintendent David Walker said that she was a bright, charming, friendly, and engaging young lady. Sometimes, however, Nicole would skip class to hang out with her friends, but she still stayed on top of her studies. If one of her loved ones was ever feeling down, Nicole would always be the first to try and cheer them up. Jason and Christine said that after Nicole failed to return home on the 12th of May, they attempted to contact her through her phone, as well as through social media. However, Nicole's phone was switched off. They called around her friends, but none of them said that they had seen her. They turned to social media in a bid to find Nicole. A Facebook group called Bring Nicole Home was set up, and thousands of members would join within just days. Missing person posters were printed in the hundreds and plastered throughout the town. They described Nicole as standing at around 5 feet 1 inch tall, weighing around 90 pounds with light brown hair and blue eyes. She was last seen wearing a pair of jeans and a pink sweater. She also had her nose, lip and ears pierced. You can see the missing person poster up on the Vodacast app. The following day, concern seemed to turn to fear, with Christine making a public plea for the safe return of her daughter during a press conference.
This is my daughter. You're scared because you ran away. You're not in trouble. Just come home. It'll be okay. And if somebody has her, I don't care. Just take her to a gas station, a park, anywhere. Whatever is going on, I don't know what to say. We're waiting for you. I'm waiting for you to call me.
She and Jason requested that they not be questioned by the media, while Deputy Chief Troy Morton revealed that the search for Nicole had been increased and that 45 law enforcement personnel, including federal, state, county and municipal, were working on the missing person case. The FBI and the National Center for Missing Children and the Maine State Police were also assisting in the search. A post on the Facebook group alleged that Nicole was in the company of a male using the fictitious name of Brian Butterfield on Facebook. Deputy Chief Morton said that he could not comment on the post, but said that all avenues were being investigated. When asked if they feared that Nicole had been kidnapped, they replied that they were going to investigate everything and rule anything out. Investigators would be searching both land and air and would be reviewing computer and cell phone records. Sheriff Glenn Ross asked for anybody who may have seen Nicole on Route 221, commonly known as Hudson Road, between 8 p.m. and 2 a.m. to please get in contact with them. Shortly thereafter, however, investigators said that they had identified somebody called Brian Butterfield, and he had come down to the police station to be interviewed. Sheriff Ross announced that there was nothing to indicate that any other action was needed by their department in this avenue, stating, "This is an active investigation. His name is out there, and perhaps he's concerned that he might be misaccused." This Brian Butterfield, however, was a real person with that real name. He had known Nicole from school, but said that they had only spoken around twice. The other Brian Butterfield Facebook profile was seemingly deleted almost as soon as Nicole went missing. Fear swept over Nicole's loved ones, and they wondered if somebody had set up a fake profile, pretending to be somebody that Nicole knew, in a bid to lure her away from home. Investigators would appeal to the public for information about a black Ford Ranger or a similar truck. They asked if anybody had seen such a vehicle near Nicole's home between 8 p.m. and 2 a.m. on the night she vanished. They revealed that they had been given information on the vehicle, but said that it may or may not have been seen in the area. Sheriff Ross said, "We want to stress that we're not looking for the names of people all over the state of Maine that may or may not own a vehicle such as this. We're only interested in a similar vehicle in that area at that time." As the search entered the sixth day, investigators asked for ground search volunteers. Up until now, only investigators had been searching the ground for Nicole, stating that they didn't want people to trample over potential evidence. They asked people wanting to volunteer to meet at a search command post at the Glenburn Fire Station.
If I let you go run rogue, someone gets hurt and someone doesn't know you're gone, we're going to be searching for you tonight. And one search is enough for this town, I think. 6, 7, 8, 9, one more.
Hey, this is search.
Okay, 10. Okay. Everyone else, please back up. I don't want you to go with this group. Basically, like I said earlier, I don't know if you guys were here or not, we're doing roadside searches. White lines out. Okay, match your team leader. Okay? No one goes rogue on him. Guys, you know, he's the guy that's responsible for 10 volunteers. So, basically a grid search. If anyone hasn't done a grid search, it's going to be you within a couple feet from the next person, looking down at the ground for any evidence at all. Something that's pertinent there. I'm not looking for cigarette butts. I'm not looking for, soda cans or water bottles at all. Okay, I'm looking for possibly a belt and possibly some jewelry or a cell phone. That's it.
They would be trudging through Glenburn and the surrounding area, including swampy and wooded terrain, which would be difficult to meander. The initial search had focused along Route 221, but now the search was expanding. You can see some footage of the search up on the Vodacast app. Nicole's family were completely proactive in the search, and Christine, her mother, thanked those who had come out to assist in the search.
I want to thank all of you for coming and helping me find my baby girl. It means the world to me that my community is here for us. And our goal is to bring her home safe. And I want to thank you for being here.
Over 500 people volunteered their time to search, including 100 trained volunteers from 17 search and rescue teams throughout Maine. Dave Martin, the president of Dorigo Search and Rescue, said that it was probably the largest volunteer search they had seen in 6 or 7 years. He would speak with Bangor Daily News.
We have a total of about 100 search and rescue volunteers from 17 different teams here, and I think about 400 civilian volunteers. It's probably the most civilian volunteers we've had on a search in 6 or 7 years that I can remember.
While investigators would remain tight-lipped about the circumstances surrounding Nicole's disappearance, they would reveal that on the night that Nicole vanished, she had left her home to meet somebody at the end of her driveway. This person, as mentioned, had been using a fake Facebook account under the name of Brian Butterfield. They also revealed that the real Brian, who had gone to school with Nicole, had been aware of the fake Facebook account, pretending to be him, and that he had warned officials about the fake account before Nicole had vanished. While it certainly appeared as though Nicole had been abducted, investigators stopped short of saying that, and simply referred to the case as a disappearance. Then on the 19th of May, over a week after Nicole vanished, there was a crushing update in the case when it was announced that Nicole's body had been found.
A body has been located in Old Town and is presumed to be that of Nicole Cable. Unfortunately, this did not end as we wanted. On behalf of every law enforcement officer that was involved in this investigation, we offer our deepest sympathy to that of the family and the friends and all of the school children that were involved with Nicole.
She had been found at around 9:30 p.m. by the Maine Warden Service in a wooded area just off Route 43 in Old Town. The medical examiner would determine that Nicole had been killed on the day that she had vanished. It would be announced that she had been the victim of homicide, but investigators kept her cause of death under wraps for the time being. You can see a photograph of the area where Nicole was found on the Vodacast app.
From the searches conducted and information from the investigative team, a wooded area near Gilman Falls in Old Town was searched last evening by four game wardens, and about 9:30 p.m., a game warden and his dog located a female body in the woods. As soon as we located that, the scene was secured and then was turned over to the Maine State Police.
Then just the following day, it was announced that 20-year-old Kyle Duby from Morono had been charged with Nicole's murder. At the time, Kyle was already in jail serving a 30-day sentence for fleeing from police on a motorcycle at more than 100 miles per hour back in June. According to Tyler Ann Harris, who was Nicole's best friend, Nicole and Kyle had met a couple of months earlier and had planned to meet over the weekend she disappeared before he had to report to jail to serve his sentence for fleeing from police. Tyler said that she had never met Kyle and wasn't really sure what kind of relationship he had with Nicole, but said that Nicole wasn't afraid of him. Tyler Ann spoke about the fake Facebook profile and said she believed that Kyle had made up the fake Facebook account, but she couldn't comprehend as to why, because Nicole spoke to Kyle and had hung out with him beforehand. According to Tyler, as soon as she heard that Nicole was missing, she tried to go on the fake Brian Butterfield Facebook page. However, it had already been deleted at some point between 9 p.m. when Nicole was last seen and 7 a.m. the following morning. Even more chilling, Kyle's own Facebook page would show that he had participated in the search for Nicole and had posted her missing person flyers on his page. Alongside the missing person poster, he had written, "Please help this family get back together. Nicole, wherever you are, I hope you're safe." His Facebook would also show that the day after Nicole disappeared, he had tried to sell a 1997 Jeep Cherokee for $1,200 and had posted complaints about men hitting on his girlfriend, who wasn't Nicole. Before Nicole's disappearance, Kyle had worked for the Getchell Agency, which is an organization that cares for people with disabilities in Bangor, Maine. However, he had quit around the same time that Nicole disappeared, presumably because he needed to report to jail for his sentence. In addition to the motorcycle incident, Kyle had more offenses on his criminal record. When he was 17 years old, he was charged with carrying a loaded firearm or crossbow in a motor vehicle, which had resulted in a conviction and a $200 fine. He had also been convicted of theft by unauthorized taking or transfer and burglary of a motor vehicle in January of 2012 and was ordered to pay a $300 fine for both. Then in February of 2012, he was convicted of theft by unauthorized taking or transfer, which resulted in a $500 fine. While Kyle had a criminal record, those who knew him said that they were extremely surprised with the arrest. Kyle lived at home with his family and had a 4-year-old daughter. Some of those who knew him described him as a sweet and innocent guy. Rachel Garber, who had graduated from high school with Kyle back in 2011, said that Kyle didn't seem like the type of person to commit such a heinous crime. She said to Bangor Daily News, "You go to school with someone, and you assume that the people you're with may get in trouble for little things like drugs or drinking, but you don't expect anything this big ever." One of his friends, Laura White, said that Kyle always appeared to be a good and attentive father to his daughter. However, there were also a number of people who knew Kyle and gave a polar opposite description of him. Zachary Day, who knew both Nicole and Kyle, said that he never really liked Kyle. Freeman Weeks, who was a former friend of Kyle, said that when they were friends, he always had problems with Kyle before finally falling out for good. He said that despite his issues with Kyle, he never believed that he would be capable of a crime such as murder. After the discovery of Nicole's body, Christine spoke outside her home and urged parents to be vigilant about their children's online activity. As she clutched a Panda Bear pillow which belonged to Nicole, she said, "If this saves someone else's child, then this won't have happened for nothing." The investigation was still under wraps and many people had been left wondering about the social media aspect of the case. Was the fake profile made by Kyle, and if so, why? Christine said that she couldn't provide details of the investigation, but said that her family believed that social media played a large role in the events that led up to Nicole's murder. Residents in both Glenburn and Orono reacted with shock and sadness upon hearing about the tragic outcome of the case. Maine is a relatively safe state with a very low crime rate, and the community felt outraged that such a horrific crime happened right on their doorstep. Old Town High School had grief counsellors on hand to offer care and support to both the students and the staff at the school, and it was announced that they would be staying at the school for as long as needed. It was also announced that students would be writing memories of Nicole into a book, and then they were going to present that book to Nicole's family at some point. Just the day after the arrest, Kyle appeared in court where the judge sealed the affidavit in the case at the request of Kyle's defence lawyer, Steve Smith, who said that he had been worried about pre-trial publicity. It was ordered that the affidavit remain sealed until after a grand jury could hear the case. Kyle showed no emotion during the brief court hearing, which had been attended by a number of Nicole's loved ones, who were all wearing neon yellow, Nicole's favourite colour, in her honour. While very little was still known about the circumstances surrounding the case, Assistant Attorney General Andrew Benson confirmed that social media had a part to play in the case, but he refused to elaborate any further. The lack of information began to lead to rumours, and a lot of people started questioning whether investigators had arrested the right person. The Associated Press and Maine Today Media would challenge the judge's decision to keep the affidavit sealed. They asked the judge to release the probable cause affidavit, which contained details from the investigation, which supported the murder charge being filed against Kyle. They argued that sealing the affidavit violated the First Amendment and court rulings that judicial proceedings and documents should be open to the public. Sigmund Schutz, who is a First Amendment lawyer, filed the motions on behalf of the news organisations. He said that affidavits may be sealed under rare circumstances, but said that this didn't apply to this case. He said that in the United States and the state of Maine, people were not put in jail for secret reasons, adding that the public had a right to know these reasons. While the judge was looking over the affidavit and reaching his decision, loved ones of Nicole, as well as the community where she lived, were coming together and planning special events to commemorate her life. They wanted to help other families cope or avoid similar tragedies. A group of people met at the Glenburn Town office to release balloons in Nicole's memory. Organisers had asked those in attendance to bring along their own balloons in any colour, but said that Nicole's favourite colour was neon yellow. There was a donation bucket at the balloon release, and all proceedings would go towards the Nicole Cable Memorial Fund. Christine said that the fund had been set up to help families who were victims of similar tragedies as they were. The family wanted the fund to serve as a legacy of Nicole, to help other people when they needed it. Around 300 people attended the balloon release. Nicole's stepfather, Jason, thanked everybody in attendance for coming. He said, "We just want everyone to know that we're not going to let Nicole's name go silently. We're going to speak very loudly for Nicole, and we want to make sure that there's a legacy left behind." Pastor Jack Dowling of Glenburn Covenant Church, who stood alongside Jason, said that the community's response to Nicole's disappearance sent the message that there was hope for a better tomorrow and love for one another. He said that the community had given strength and encouragement, not only to Nicole's loved ones, but to the community as a whole. The Work Store, which was a small print shop located in Glenburn, announced that they were going to be making stickers, sweatshirts, and t-shirts, which memorialised Nicole. All of the proceeds from the sale of the items would be going towards the fund. In the space of just a few days, the Work Store sold around $1,000 worth of merchandise. I've recently become obsessed with Foreo, and they've sponsored this episode. Foreo exists to reinvent beauty and wellness by offering innovative devices that install confidence and improve your skin. I've been using the Luna 3, which features thin touch points for cleansing your face. I've also been using the UFO Mini, which is a 90-second face treatment utilizing hyper-infusion technology. It leaves my skin glowing and radiant in just 90 seconds. I have quite sensitive skin, and Foreo genuinely leaves my skin feeling amazing. I've also been using the massage function on Luna 3, which directs lower frequency pulsations to wrinkle-prone areas and smooths the appearance of fine lines. I've been doing this for a couple of weeks now and already see a difference in the look and feel of my skin. Foreo are offering Morbidology listeners an Amazon bundle, which includes the Luna 3, the UFO Mini, and Call It A Night UFO Activated Mask. The set is valued at $307.99 and retails on Amazon at $249. But with the code MORBID50, you can get it for $199. There are two other bundles, but that's the one I've got. It's been a tough year and a half for all of us, and it's about time we deserve to have that moment of pampering zen. I swear by their products now and use them every single day. Just click the link in my show notes to the Amazon bundles, or go to Foreo's Amazon shop and click the bundles tab and use code MORBID50 for 35% off. Is there something interfering with your happiness, or are you apprehensive about reaching out for help? BetterHelp is here to help you and they're today's sponsor of Morbidology. BetterHelp is not self-help, it's professional counselling available to you online or over the phone. BetterHelp is more affordable and accessible than traditional offline counselling, and they offer financial aid. Sadly, sometimes traditional offline counselling is not locally available for everybody, but BetterHelp is available for clients worldwide. They have licensed professional counsellors specialising in a broad variety of areas, including depression, sleeping, self-esteem, grief, and much more. Everything you share with your counsellor is confidential and they are matched to your specific needs. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/morbidology. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/morbidology. Nicole was laid to rest on the 26th of May. Her funeral was held at the Bangor Baptist Church, and over 300 people came to pay their final respects. As funeral home attendants began to wheel Nicole's lavender casket up the aisle of the church, her mother jumped off her seat and asked them to wait. Christine, who was understandably distraught, ran up to the closed casket and put her arms around it, embracing her daughter for one last time. She kissed the lid before slowly returning to her seat. Surrounding Nicole's casket was photographs depicting her short life. Her loved ones would speak about her spirited character and her infectious smile. Standing before the mourners, Christine said, "I know in my heart you will be with me always. I will miss your laughter and your smile and your sweet kisses on my cheeks. I know that you have not left us and that you never will." Jimmy Robertson, whose daughter Haley was one of Nicole's best friends, urged the mourners to remember what a gift Nicole was. Following the service, Nicole was buried during a private burial. Just a couple of days after the funeral service, an affidavit was released which finally gave the public some more insight into the murder of Nicole. It revealed that Kyle certainly had been behind the fake Facebook profile. He had set it up to try and lure Nicole out of her home. He had staged a kidnapping and rescue so that he could look like a hero, but ended up killing her. Kyle had used the Facebook account to trick Nicole into coming outside her home while he was waiting in the woods, wearing a ski mask. When Nicole came outside, Kyle jumped out from his hiding spot, grabbed Nicole, put duct tape over her mouth, and stuffed her into the back of his father's black pickup truck. According to the affidavit, When Kyle stopped the car, Nicole was dead, so he dumped her body and covered it with branches. Kyle had told his brother that he had intended to kidnap Nicole and hide her somewhere, but then he would be the one to later find her and be the hero. It would also be revealed that the real Brian Butterfield had told investigators that he had always believed that Kyle was behind the Facebook profile. He said that Kyle had wanted to have sex with Nicole, but she had turned down his advances. Investigators had gotten the records to identify the owner of the Facebook account, and it led them directly to Kyle's parents' home. They were able to determine that it was Kyle behind the fake Facebook page, because he was logging into his own account and then into the fake account within minutes of each other. Facebook also informed investigators that the last four digits of the mobile phone used to disable the account were the last four digits of Kyle's mobile phone number. The affidavit also revealed that Kyle had confessed to the murder to his girlfriend, Sarah Mersinger, and his brother, Dustin Duby. When Kyle was interviewed by an investigator on the 15th of May, he said that he had a relationship with Nicole, but was working in Bangor on the night that she vanished. He said that he had texted her earlier on in the day. Investigators had also been able to link Kyle to the murder via DNA at the kidnap scene. There appeared to be a struggle at the scene. A blue hat with a hole cut in it, a sock, and a black sneaker which belonged to Nicole were found in a wooded area near Nicole's home, just days after she had vanished. DNA testing would show that Kyle's DNA was found on the hat and the sock. When Kyle was interviewed, he had scratches to his face, and he claimed that he got them while at work. Kyle would be indicted by a grand jury on charges of kidnap and murder. After the affidavit was released, Christine publicly spoke about the case. She said that Nicole believed that who she was speaking to was her classmate, Brian Butterfield. She said that she had told Nicole that she couldn't spend time with Kyle, in part because of the high-speed police chase he had been involved in. He wasn't the type of person that they wanted their daughter to be associated with. According to Christine, while Nicole and Kyle had been friends in the past, she was done with him. Shortly before she vanished, Nicole had texted a friend that she was going to meet Brian, which indicated that Nicole had no idea that the profile she had been speaking with was fake. More documents would be released which revealed that just the day before Nicole had vanished, she had told her boyfriend that Kyle had groped her. In text messages to her boyfriend, Nicole said that when Kyle had groped her and attempted to kiss her, she tried to push him off, but he wouldn't get off. She also said that Kyle left a bite mark on her. Despite this, Nicole continued to text Kyle. She texted him the following day saying that he had left a bite mark on her, to which he replied, "Sorry." She responded with, "It's fine." On the 12th of May, Nicole told Kyle via text message that she was going to meet up with a guy she knew called Brian Butterfield to get a free 20 bag of marijuana. Nicole was seemingly unaware that she was actually speaking to Kyle, not Brian. Kyle had ironically replied to Nicole, "Just remember to call me or anything if you need me." To which Nicole replied, "All right, I will. Is it weird to be a little scared?" A couple of days later, Nicole's cause of death would finally be released. The medical examiner who conducted the autopsy determined that she had died from asphyxia due to compression of the neck. This was contradictory to Kyle's claims that she had seemingly suffocated from the duct tape. Kyle subsequently appeared in court where he pleaded not guilty to the murder of Nicole. His defense lawyer, Steve Smith, requested that he have a psychological examination to determine competency. In his motion, he wrote that he believed that there was a basis to request a determination of his competency at the time of the offense, as well as to determine any factors which could assist the defense in mitigation at sentencing. The judge would grant the request, and Kyle was ordered to undergo psychological examination. If he were to be found competent, then a judge would need to conclude that Kyle understands the nature of the charges against him, comprehends his own condition in relation to said charges, and the consequences of a conviction, as well as be able to assist in his own defense. In the middle of the following month, Kyle would be charged with an unrelated burglary, A search of his home uncovered a gun which had been stolen from a home in Kandaskeag, as well as items from another burglary. Shortly thereafter, a further affidavit would also be released, which revealed that in addition to Nicole, Kyle had used the fake Facebook page to contact other teenage girls. Kyle would be found competent to stand trial. And his trial was scheduled for February of 2015. His defence team filed a motion to have the trial moved to another county because of the pre-trial publicity, which included Christine and Jason appearing on the Dr. Phil show to talk about the dangers of meeting people online. With the trial fast approaching early the following year, it was announced there would be a hearing to discuss the trial being moved. There would also be a hearing to discuss statements that Kyle had made to a corrections officer as well as two investigators. His defence team were hoping to get statements suppressed. During the hearing, Robert Susie, who is a corrections officer, testified that when Kyle showed up to begin his sentence for the police chase, he appeared to be very emotional and was crying. Robert asked him how long he would be in jail, and when he replied that it was 30 days, he said that wasn't a long sentence. Kyle then replied, "It's what I've done that they don't know I've done that I'm worrying about." Detective Thomas Pickering then testified that before being interviewed in regards to the murder of Nicole, Kyle had been read his Miranda rights before both of the interviews, and he agreed to answer questions. Court documents just before the trial was scheduled to begin revealed that Kyle's defence team were wanting to name Kyle's girlfriend, Sarah, as an alternative suspect in Nicole's murder. Sarah had dated the real Ryan Butterfield in the past, and their defence wanted to suggest that Sarah disliked Nicole enough to kill her and knew enough about Brian to set up the fake Facebook account. There had been text messages from Sarah which read, "Why do you care if she's missing? It was because of her own stupidity. It's her fault she put herself in a position to be kidnapped. You don't know the whole story." She was messaging that Brian Butterfield and asking him for cigarettes and gave him her address, even though the pic on the Facebook was of somebody with a surfboard and blonde hair. "It's her fault for being stupid, so I'm lolling." Defence Smith argued that there was ample evidence to suggest that Sarah could have been an alternative suspect in the murder. Judge Anne Murray, however, decided that naming Sarah as an alternative suspect was not admissible in court. She said, "The defendant's proffer in this case involved only speculation and conjecture, and therefore evidence of the alternative suspect is not admissible." She also granted the defence's motion to exclude some portions of statements that Kyle had made to investigators. The murder trial began on the 22nd of February, 2015. During the opening statements of defence lawyer Wendy Hatch, she said that the state had rushed to judge Kyle and put forward the theory that Kyle was completely innocent of the murder and that somebody else had carried it out. She claimed that Kyle was at home with his family when Nicole was being abducted. Turning to the jury, she said, "We are here to show you that the state has holes in their case. They have mistakes, big mistakes." She said that just the day after Nicole's disappearance, Kyle got up, got dressed, kissed his daughter, and then went to work. She was clearly trying to imply that this was not the behaviour of a guilty man. Assistant Attorney General Donald McComber, on the other hand, said that Kyle's DNA had been found underneath Nicole's fingernails, and that following her disappearance he had scratches to his face. He also mentioned that Kyle had alluded to the crime while having an emotional outburst while reporting to jail for the earlier police chase. Addressing the jury, he said, "Kyle responded it was about what he had done that they didn't know he had done, that he was worried about." The first witness to be called to testify was Christine. She testified that she knew Kyle as a friend of Nicole's who had come by their home around 2 or 3 times before she disappeared. At the time, Kyle was 19 years old, and Christine had a rule that Nicole couldn't date boys over the age of 17. She said that she questioned Kyle, and he said that they were just friends. She chillingly stated that after Nicole had vanished, Kyle had reached out to her and offered to babysit her other children. She told the jury that the night Nicole vanished, she had told her that she was going to walk down the drive to meet somebody to get smokes. Christine knew that Nicole smoked, but she said that she wasn't allowed to do it in the house. This was the last conversation that she ever had with her daughter. Later on, when Nicole didn't return a text message or answer her phone, Christine became concerned. She said that she felt as though something was wrong. Her testimony would be followed by testimony from another emotionally distraught mother, the mother of Kyle. Tabby Duby testified that she had met Nicole 2 or 3 weeks before she died, when Kyle brought her around to the house. She said that at the time, Kyle's girlfriend, Sarah, wasn't there. Brian Butterfield would also be called as a prosecution witness. On the stand, he said that a couple of weeks before Nicole was killed, he reported to police that somebody had set up a fake Facebook profile using his identity and had used the page to talk to underage girls. He also spoke about his earlier breakup with Sarah. He described the breakup as messy and said that at one point, he had even considered seeking a protection from harassment order against her. His testimony would be followed by 2 neighbours of the Wiley family, who told the courtroom how on the 12th of May, at some point between 9 p.m. and 10 p.m, they had heard a woman scream, but neither reported it to police. As mentioned a little bit earlier in this episode, Kyle had claimed that the scratches to his face had come from work. However, during trial, his co-worker, Clifford Redman, contradicted this by stating that the scratches were not the kind you would get from work, and they only appeared the day after Nicole vanished. It was evident that they were fresh scratches. On the weekend of the 11th and 12th of May, Clifford and Kyle had been at the home of a mentally ill woman, caring for her. During their time there, the woman had become violent and clawed Kyle's face near his eye. They filled out an incident report, but on the 13th of May, Clifford said that he noticed there were new scratches on Kyle's face, which hadn't come from the attack. Another co-worker, Jack Merritt, testified that on the 12th of May at around 8:45 p.m, he had arrived at work and that Kyle had left around 10 or 15 minutes later and then returned at around 6 a.m. the following day. He said to the courtroom that Kyle asked him not to tell anybody and to lie and say that he had been at the house all night. Workers were expected to spend the night at the client's home and not leave. According to Jack, at least half of the nights where Kyle was supposed to spend the night, he did not. The interviews that Kyle had with investigators would be played out for the jury. In the very first conversation he had, he said he thought that Nicole had gone off to hang out with some friends for a couple of days and would return home eventually. In a later interview, he repeatedly denied that he was behind the fake Facebook account. During the interview, he said, "I was stunned when police said it was from my parents' IP address. I have not, never in my life, changed or made a different account for Facebook. I have never, I would never lie about that. I want to find her." Much of the trial would focus on forensic and computer evidence. Brent Bewley of the Bangor Police Department testified that he had traced the Facebook page back to Kyle. Facebook chats were shown between Nicole and the fake account from the afternoon of the 12th of May. They included plans for the two to meet and smoke marijuana together, with Nicole giving directions to her home. At around 9:18 p.m, the chats stopped, and there was no communication on Facebook after that. The following morning, the fake Facebook page was deactivated. Under cross-examination from the defence, Officer Brent said that anybody who knew the passwords for the fake account could have used it, adding that the fake account was used by Kyle's phone as opposed to anybody else's. Michelle Fleury, a chemist with the Maine State Police Crime Lab, testified that there was no semen or human blood found on the clothing that was found at the side of the road. This clothing was determined to be the clothing that Nicole was wearing when she vanished. Dr. Margaret Greenwald from the State Medical Examiner's Office testified that there were linear abrasions on Nicole's neck and scratches under her chin. There were also multiple abrasions to her forehead, left eye, left cheek, nose and lip. She testified that her cause of death was asphyxia due to compression of the neck. One of the most highly anticipated moments of the trial came when Sarah, Kyle's now former girlfriend, testified. She said that Kyle had confessed to the murder to her after his interview with investigators on the 16th of May. Sarah herself had also been questioned by investigators, and she left the police station with the belief that based on what they had asked her, they believed that Kyle was involved in Nicole's murder. When Sarah confronted Kyle about this, he allegedly confessed. She testified that when he came home from his interview with investigators, he was visibly upset. When asked what Kyle had said, she replied, "He told me that he strangled her at the end of her road. He said that he had a mask on when he strangled her. He said he put duct tape on her mouth, her eyes, and on her hands and feet." She then told the jury that when Kyle put Nicole in the truck and drove towards the woods where she would be found, he didn't know if she was dead or alive. She testified, "He said he carried her on his back into the woods, then checked her pulse, but there was none. He said he took her clothes off so the dogs couldn't smell her. He said he covered her with sticks and leaves, so they couldn't see her from the sky." On the witness stand, she admitted that she did not tell investigators what Kyle had told her until the 20th of May. She said that Kyle's mother, Tammy, had advised her not to talk to police. She would be questioned about statements she had made to investigators wherein she said she held grudges and was a very violent person. She also said that she would kill Kyle in his sleep if she found out that he had been sleeping with Nicole. When asked if she regretted making those statements, she responded, "Every day." While the judge had ruled that Sarah could not be named during trial as an alternative witness, the defense strongly suggested during cross-examination that jurors should consider Sarah as a person who wanted Nicole dead. She would be forced to deny that she had created the fake Facebook page and deny that she knew Kyle's username or password for Facebook. She also had to deny under cross-examination that she was the one who killed Nicole. Sarah's testimony would be followed by testimony from her mother, Catherine Najala. She said that on the 13th of May, which was Mother's Day, she had spent the day with Sarah. She told the courtroom that Kyle was supposed to pick Sarah up between 9 p.m. and 10 p.m. However, she said that he didn't arrive until 11 p.m. Testimony would also be heard from David Tenney, who was incarcerated with Kyle. He testified that Kyle had confessed to the murder to him. He said that Kyle told him that Nicole looked like she needed to be killed, and he wanted to kill her. Another fellow inmate, Kyle Ellis, also testified that Kyle had told him that he had choked a girl and to try to make it look like he was helping her. He said that Kyle had told him that he was a really good person who just does dumb stuff. There were two other inmates who would testify about the same thing. Under cross-examination, only one out of the four inmates admitted that he had asked for a reduced sentence in return for his testimony. Another highly anticipated moment of the trial came when Kyle's brother, Dustin, testified. While it had been reported that Kyle allegedly confessed to Dustin when he took to the witness stand, he denied this. He now claimed that he had heard Kyle was responsible for Nicole's murder through Sarah. Dustin's co-worker, Sean Kasprick, however, would testify that Dustin had told him that Kyle had confessed to the murder to him. Dustin claimed that he did not remember this conversation. Maine State Police Detective Jay Pelletier also testified that Dustin had told him during an interview that he had heard straight from Kyle the details of how he killed Nicole and where he had hidden her body. It appeared that now Kyle was on trial for murder, Dustin had changed his version of events. It would be revealed towards the end of the trial that Kyle had actually written a detailed confession while awaiting trial. The handwritten document included a diagram of the area near Nicole's home, which showed Kyle hiding in the woods at the end of her road. It also showed where the mask was found, as well as Nicole's shoes. On the handwritten document, he had written, "I made a Facebook account to prank my friend Nicole. I had her meet me at the end of her driveway and then I jumped out and scared the shit out of her. She passed out and then I freaked out. I put duct tape on her to keep her from running off. I put her in my trunk and then went for a drive, thinking she would wake up. After 15 to 20 minutes, she didn't get up. I checked her pulse and she was dead. I did CPR, but it didn't work. I panicked. I was already coming to jail, so didn't want to get charged for murder. So I put her body in the woods and took her clothes off and scraped her nails from my DNA, covered her up and then left. I threw her clothes out into the woods down the road, but the cops found them. However, on page 4 of the handwritten document, Cal had changed his version of events. He mentioned the fake Facebook, but then admitted that he had choked Nicole. He wrote, "I jump out wearing a ski mask. I grabbed her around the chest and stomach, so I thought, and then I realized I had her in a chokehold with my right arm over her neck area. She passed out, and I freaked out." In this confession, he also wrote that Nicole had ripped off his ski mask and scratched his face. He wrote that he duct taped her hands and feet and then placed her in the trunk, adding that she was breathing when he drove off. He continued, "The truth is, I never meant for her to die. She passed out after jumping her from behind and then died in the trunk. I didn't hit her or drown her or choke her or shoot her. She just stopped breathing. I should have called 911 and got help, but I was so scared. That's why I'm here. Because I was shit scared and didn't call for help." Kyle's palm print was also discovered on the handwritten confession. A number of people were anticipating that Kyle would take the stand in his own defense. However, Kyle opted against it. In closing arguments, Assistant Attorney General Leanne Zena said to the jury that all of the evidence presented showed that Kyle, and only Kyle, kidnapped and murdered Nicole. She reminded the jury that Kyle's DNA was found on a hat and sock at the end of the road where Nicole lived, and his DNA was also found underneath Nicole's fingernails. She said that Kyle's confession contained details that hadn't been publicly released, including the information that Nicole had scratched him with her fingernails. Defense Attorney Smith, on the other hand, said that Kyle had no motive to kill Nicole because they were friends. In a bid to put reasonable doubt in the mind of the jurors, he said that Sarah hated Nicole and had access to Kyle's phone and computer. The jury would need to first of all consider the murder charge. If they found that he wasn't guilty of murder, then they would move on to consider manslaughter. You can see more about the trial on the Vodacast app. The jury would deliberate for less than an hour. They would find Kyle Dubey guilty of the murder of Nicole Cable. As the verdict was read out, the silence of the courtroom was shattered by the sound of two clapping hands. It was Nicole's father, David. Other family members began to cry and console one another. Deputy Attorney General Lisa Marchese said that the swift verdict reflected the overwhelming case against Kyle. Assistant Attorney Donald McComber would speak with WMTW-TV outside of court.
"He brutally murdered a 15-year-old girl, left her like a piece of garbage out in the woods, didn't take it seriously then, and throughout these proceedings he didn't take it seriously. He'll never set foot outside again."
The sentencing phase would follow. The prosecution would state that Kyle had planned to abduct Nicole and sexually assault her, but then when she resisted, he killed her. Nicole's family would be in court to try and ensure that Kyle be handed the harshest sentence possible. During victim impact statements, Christine said that Nicole's three younger sisters live in fear that the bad man will come for them next. She said she had so many dreams. Dreams of getting her driver's license, turning sweet 16. She had dreams of getting married and having one child. Kyle's family would also be there to try and secure a more lenient sentence. His mother, Tammy, said that her son was a loving father to his 4-year-old daughter and asked the judge to take into consideration that he was still young. Kyle Dubey would be sentenced to 60 years for the murder and 30 years for the kidnapping. In handing down the sentence, the judge cited an utter lack of remorse. He said that Kyle had the calculating presence of mind immediately after killing Nicole, to remove her clothing and hide her body in the woods, before returning home to his girlfriend.
I feel good about the 60 years. I think that's, he'll be very old before he could ever get out. It's a prison life, so there's no guarantees that he would even live that long. What he did to Nicole, the terror she must have felt that night. I know she fought with everything she had.
It's a significant sentence. It does allow him for some hope of getting out when he's in his 70s.
The internet can be a wonderful tool to connect people. It can help us learn, make new friends, and stay in touch with old friends. The internet, however, also has many dangerous pitfalls. The disturbing abduction and murder of Nicole Cable was a chilling reminder for all parents across the world that far too often, they don't actually know who their children are speaking to online. What made this case all the more terrifying, however, is that Nicole wasn't actually speaking to a stranger. She was speaking to somebody she believed was her classmate, but behind that screen was somebody who she believed was her friend. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd like to say a big, massive thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporters, Heather, Andy, Sonia, Evelina, and Dawn. If you'd like to support the show on Patreon, the link is in the show notes. In return for your support, you get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, which aren't on the regular podcast platforms, merch, ad-free and early release episodes, behind the scenes, including bonus audio and case files, and much more. Can I ask a huge favour and ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, please consider leaving me a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Ratings and reviews are an easy way to support a show that you like, and I would be eternally grateful. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the podcast, One Strange Thing. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
We all enjoy a little mystery. Every other week, One Strange Thing presents forgotten stories from America's news archives. They all have something in common, a single element that can't quite be explained. I'm Laura Norton. Join me on One Strange Thing, and you'll hear about a class ring that disappeared on one continent and reappeared on another, and the ominous whistling that terrorized a young bride in Louisiana, and the chemical warfare once waged on a sleepy town in Illinois. And then there's the house in Atlanta that once dripped human blood. And that's just the start. No matter the place or the people, One Strange Thing brings you stories that are very real and just a little otherworldly. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.